From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The U.S.-Mexico border is overwhelmed. The number of unaccompanied minors there has surged. More than 3,400 are being held at the border as of today. That's even more than during the spike in 2019. A delegation of Republican lawmakers is in El Paso, Texas today. They're seeing the crisis for themselves and pointing fingers at President Biden. They say he invited the surge in migrants by loosening former President Trump's hardline immigration policies. For his part, Biden is sending the Federal Emergency Management Administration to the border for support. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is here for more. Franco, first, what do we know about the migrants at the border, how old they are and where they're coming from?
Well, largely they're coming from Central America. That's like Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. And many of them are unaccompanied children. So some are traveling with their families, but a lot are traveling alone or with another parent. So we have a lot of kids who are arriving, as you noted, unaccompanied. And the Biden administration is having a very difficult time finding where to put them.
So it's hoping that FEMA will help be able to organize things a bit. Exactly what will FEMA's role be?
Yeah, for the next 90 days, emergency specialists from FEMA will help process these children, help find them shelters and beds. And, you know, this is a challenge that has been made a lot more difficult because of the pandemic and social distancing. It's, you know, a real recognition of the severity of the emergency. You know, these are kids who are supposed to be moved quickly to more appropriate shelters run by Health and Human Services, but they're arriving faster than the Biden administration can process them and find them beds. And they're having to be kept in basically jail-like facilities.
In jail-like facilities, what else do we know about the conditions they're being kept in?
Well, they could be either, you know, warehouse-type facilities where they're maybe in type of like cage-like facilities. I mean, we talked about kids in cages in the past, and these are some of those facilities. Others are in kind of tent cities, but sometimes the lights are on 24 hours a day. These are facilities that, you know, immigration and border patrol facilities officials have told me are facilities that were built for adults, not only adults and sometimes for criminals. So these are not places for kids and who are having to sleep sometimes on the floor, on a mat, under just like a blanket. They need to have beds. It's not appropriate for kids. And I think most people will agree with that.
So what does the Biden administration say about that? I mean, we have President Biden who's still celebrating the passage of the nearly $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill last week. Now the border crisis has gotten worse. As you say, the conditions for the young people who are there seem to be abhorrent. And Republicans say it's his policies, Biden's policies, that led to the crisis. What's the administration saying?
Yeah, I mean, that's why they're sending FEMA. They are acknowledging there was a big discussion on whether this was a crisis or not, but them sending FEMA there now is a clear acknowledgement that this is an emergency. They are saying that some of this migration does not, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether this is responsibility, as you know, of the Biden administration or the earlier Trump administration. And what I can say is, like, there have been these waves in the past. You know, the White House has acknowledged some responsibility for the timing. But in 2014, there was a wave under the Obama administration. And then in 2018 and 2019, there was another wave under the Trump administration. So we've had these surges in the past. Often they're cyclical, even when you had Trump's harsh policies.
And so Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, says that Biden inherited a broken immigration system from Donald Trump. Is there any will on Capitol Hill to try to reform it?
Yeah, I think we're soon going to find out how much. You know, Biden did introduce this comprehensive package, but what quickly became clear was how difficult it'd be to pass a comprehensive package that does all the things that Biden wants. Democrats are now going to try and take up the legislation or the agenda in smaller pieces. They're going to introduce bills to protect Dreamers, another one to protect farm workers, and also immigrants with temporary protections. But as we're talking about, Republicans are using the crisis at the border to do everything they can to kind of change the narrative and kind of stymie this effort. You know, so we shall see. I mean, I think we're going to find out. What we do know is a comprehensive package with this much pushback from Republicans would be very difficult to get through.
And as you mentioned, the DACA issue, a Texas federal judge is preparing to rule on a case related to undocumented immigrants brought to the country as children, the so-called Dreamers, that would likely send the DACA case to the Supreme Court. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And let's go further south to Brazil, where COVID-19 has now killed more than 278,000 people, the second highest death toll in the world behind the U.S. The numbers keep rising. Last week, Brazil reported 2,000 deaths in a single day for the first time since the pandemic began. Philip Reeves is NPR's South America correspondent. He's based in Rio de Janeiro. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
And we've been hearing a lot about these highly contagious new strains of the virus, including the P1 variant, which originated in the Amazon city of Manaus. Is that what's driving the surge in Brazil right now?
Well, it partly is. I mean, researchers here say variants, including P1, but also the variants from the UK and South Africa, are responsible for the majority of cases in six of Brazil's 26 states. But that's by no means the only factor. A lot of Brazilians simply aren't complying with isolation measures, some for economic and social reasons, others because they simply decided not to. And you know, they went out partying at New Year and during carnival season, and now the country's paying the price for this, according to officials. I mean, just on Saturday night, right outside my window here, after the worst ever week in the pandemic in Brazil, there were hundreds of young Brazilians quaffing beer on the streets without masks. Mm. And then on top of that, of course, you've got the role played by President Jair Bolsonaro. You know, he's always been against isolation efforts. He insists the economic damage that they cause is worse than the virus itself. And only last week, he was lambasting governors and mayors again. Those mayors and governors are now desperately trying to stop their health systems collapsing by imposing new restrictions. And Bolsonaro once again spoke out against that.
Well, in fact, Bolsonaro seemed to have recently told people to stop whining about the coronavirus. And as we've been reporting in this past year, politics have played a part in Brazil's response to COVID, much as they have in the United States. It almost seemed at one point that Bolsonaro and President Trump were on a parallel track on this issue. But how are people now that we're a year into this and the crisis hasn't gone away, how are people reacting to how Bolsonaro is handling this problem?
Well, Bolsonaro still has a significant number of supporters. And they were out on the streets just this weekend, driving around in convoys, protesting against restrictions that are being imposed in various cities around the country and towns. So they're still there. But there's no doubt that there is a lot of anger and despair about what's happening with this pandemic. There's, you know, it's frustrating people. It's causing a lot of frustration. And many Brazilians are angry and frightened and just appalled. And there are signs that the political tide may now be turning against Bolsonaro. And there's a new big factor in play here. Bolsonaro's arch rival, the former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, or Lula as everyone calls him, has suddenly leapt back into the limelight. He'd been barred from running for office after being convicted of corruption. Those convictions were last week annulled by a judge. And that means Lula, at least for now, qualifies to run in next year's election. He's not the superstar he once was, but he's making an impact in this pandemic issue. You know, he says that Bolsonaro must stop being ignorant. He says Bolsonaro needs to get all Brazilians vaccinated as soon as possible. So he's putting on the pressure. And on Saturday, Lula was vaccinated in front of the TV cameras. He's one of the great political heavyweights of Latin America, and his comeback clearly worries Bolsonaro and might explain why Bolsonaro's, suddenly sounding a little more positive about vaccines.
Mm. At the same time, we see that ICU capacity is at or above 80% across the country. How are hospitals coping with this latest surge?
Well, I'm afraid the answer is that many of them are not. Some health systems in Brazil are already collapsing. There are cities with hundreds of people on waiting lists for intensive care beds. There are multiple reports of patients dying even before they can get a bed. Sometimes patients are being transferred to other parts of the country, but you know, hospitals in much of Brazil are already struggling all over the place. The state of Sao Paulo accounts for about a quarter of Brazil's COVID deaths, and reports from there say that it now has more COVID patients than ever before in intensive care. Officials are worrying that the system's going to be overwhelmed, and so from today they're imposing a bunch of emergency restrictions, closing down bars and beaches, banning soccer games and religious services, and so on.
So clearly a crisis, and yet, Phil, just about 2% of Brazil's population has been fully vaccinated so far. What's going on with that?
Well, indeed. I mean, Brazil's universal public health system used to be admired worldwide for its national vaccination programs, eliminating polio, for example. You know, it's proved in the past that it can vaccinate millions of people right across the map in a very short time. But the vaccination program is a mess. It's very slow. There's a shortage of supply. In fact, here in Rio, the second city of Brazil, vaccinations are actually suspended because they've run out of doses. A lot of this has to do with Bolsonaro's position on this. He's actively subverted efforts to get people vaccinated, although, as I say, he's changing slightly now. And now we're seeing the government scrambling to find sources of vaccine very late in the day.
All right. Definitely a problem there in Brazil. Thanks for keeping an eye on it for us. NPR South America correspondent Philip Reeves, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
How much is it worth to convince vaccine-resistant Americans to get a COVID-19 vaccine? Well, the Biden administration is ready to spend about $1.5 billion to make its case to Americans. The White House will soon launch a massive media campaign on several fronts to bring people who are hesitating on board with the shot, and it's targeting some very specific groups. Lev Fasher is covering the story for our partners at STAT, which focuses on health science and medicine. Lev, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And how exactly will the Biden administration go about spending this pretty sizable chunk of money?
Right. So in the bill from Congress that President Biden signed into law just last week, there's a full $1 billion for the CDC to go about this public relations campaign, essentially to convince Americans that the existing COVID vaccines are both safe and effective. And I think we're going to see a pretty massive media buy across TV, across radio, and a lot of digital outlets, as well as a lot of non-traditional outlets, you know, maybe online entertainment shows, some folks on Instagram or on Facebook, but not just a by-the-book traditional PR campaign, really an effort to reach Americans absolutely wherever they are. And of course, there are a lot of different communities that might be having trouble convincing every single person to take a vaccine for whatever reason. So this can't be a one-size-fits-all approach.
Right, and we can start talking about some of those groups. For one, conservatives, an NPR PBS Marist poll found that the most vaccine-resistant group in the country is Republican men. 49% said they wouldn't take the vaccine. Is it realistic, do you think, that the government could convince them to change their minds?
Right. It's a built-in challenge off the bat for President Biden and his administration, because one of the populations that's going to be most difficult to educate and to convince is maybe precisely the population least likely to take advice from Joe Biden. And the White House knows that, and public health officials understand that. And one of the tenets of this campaign, I think, is really roping in people from the community level, from churches, mayors of small towns, people who actually you know people in their communities on an individual level and can have conversations. So this campaign isn't just TV ads that people are going to watch, you know, as they watch an awards show, a baseball game, whatever it is. There's going to be a lot of money doled out in much smaller increments to local communities across the country and of very different shapes and sizes to make sure that the people spreading the word about these vaccines aren't just, you know, big-time Biden administration officials, Tony Fauci, but are actually people who have a degree of built-in trust at a more local, personal level.
Yeah, well, Dr. Anthony Fauci has said that it would help if the former president, Donald Trump, came out and pushed his supporters to take the shot, but he also said this yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
We've got to dissociate political persuasion from what's common sense, no-brainer public health things. The history of vaccinology has rescued us from smallpox, from polio, from measles, from all of the other diseases. What is the problem here? This is a vaccine that is going to be life-saving for millions of people.
Can you characterize for us the level of concern among health experts if, you know, 15 or 20% or more of Americans decide they don't want to get that vaccine?
Right. So there's a lot of cautious optimism, I would say, both in the broader public health community as well as within the Biden administration and CDC officials. The vaccine rollout really is gaining steam. We're administering well over 2 million vaccines per day. And in the early going, demand has not been a problem. Many of the most vulnerable Americans, whether that's based on health status or age or your profession, have just been very, very eager to go get vaccinated. I think the concern is that we might not be able to fully eradicate COVID. You know, it's not really thought that there are going to be zero cases of COVID in the U.S. moving forward. But I think that 20 to 25%, folks are worried about the difference between a slow burn where this disease continues to spread and a situation in a much better context, if the uptake really does get to where public health officials want it, where the COVID crisis is effectively over. Again, not zero cases, but very, very few. So I think that's the bridge they're looking to gap, that final, whether it's 10%, 20, 25%, that final slice of the population really could make the difference between some COVID and hopefully very close to none.
We have just about 45 seconds here, but there's another group that may be hesitant to get this shot. Young people, maybe they just don't feel the threat of the disease in the same way. How will this ad blitz reach them?
I think we'll see that in terms of really messaging via non-traditional outlets, influencers on social media, folks who have online-based shows, not just network TV. But the administration is quite aware of, three groups in particular, people of color, conservatives, and young people that they want to really channel these messages towards. So I think we'll see really targeted digital messaging too.
All right, Lev Fesher writing about the Biden administration's $1.5 billion media blitz to get people vaccinated. Lev, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Relief bills are invariably packed with things that have nothing to do with government relief funding. The bill Congress passed late last year included tax breaks for particular industries and provisions to counter online piracy. There was also a specific section intended to help struggling artists. But as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, critics worry it could complicate how we use the internet.
Jeff Sedlick gets ripped off all the time. He's a photographer. People grab his pictures off the internet and put them on t-shirts, mugs, calendars.
I could go on Amazon right now and find several thousand products with my images on them.
He tells me to search for Miles Davis.
If you scroll down, you'll see fashion case for iPhone. You'll see Miles Davis holding his finger to his lips.
In this picture, Davis stares down the lens, Sedlick's lens. He took that haunting picture in 1989. Well, these days, Sedlick says, you can take an amazing snapshot with a cell phone. That photo was the culmination of a lifetime of training and months of work.
I worked for a year on sketching concepts, getting access to Miles, discussing with him the potential concepts that I would like to shoot. I went to his house with a 20-foot truck loaded with equipment.
Sedlick would be making thousands from that photo if it was licensed legally. On top of that, whenever the photographer tells Amazon to take these products down,
they come right back up within a week.
Sedlick is among the artists who've pushed for the CASE Act. Basically, it creates a small claims court to solve these disputes. Otherwise, they'd go to federal court, which is way expensive. Keith Cooperschmidt runs the Copyright Alliance, which has lobbied for the CASE Act for years.
This isn't about the big movie studios or the big record labels or anything. They have enough money, they have enough lawyers, they can go to federal court when they're ripped off.
The Copyright Alliance does include Disney and Warner Media, as well as independent creators like photographer Jeff Sedlick. Here's how the CASE Act will work for him.
I fill out the paperwork, and I notify the infringer that I'd like to do that.
The infringer, who allegedly used his photo without permission. That person served a notice from the Copyright Office letting them know they're liable for up to $30,000 per claim.
And then the infringer can say, no, I don't want to be in small claims.
That's right. The alleged infringer can just opt out, leaving Sedlick with nothing. So, Keith Cooperschmidt, why bother with the CASE Act at all?
It's not about hauling people into court and getting them to pay these fines. It's about negotiating a settlement so the person actually licenses the work if they should have, okay? Or just an educational function where the person goes, oh crap, I'll stop what I'm doing, and that's good enough.
But the CASE Act could be unconstitutional, says Meredith Rose, a lawyer with the consumer advocacy group Public Knowledge. She says it might violate the separation between judicial and governing branches.
Fundamentally, you're putting a court system inside the Library of Congress, which is part of Congress.
And the CASE Act, she says, could lead to a cottage industry of lawsuits aimed at people who don't even know they're infringing.
The way that people just use the internet on a day-to-day basis, just without thinking twice in most cases, gives rise to copyright liability, and this could turbocharge that.
Think of all the memes, GIFs, videos, and photographs.
You know, you just think about, like, my mom posted our wedding photos online. You know, I don't know that she had the right to do that under our photographer's contract. Nobody's reading those.
Maybe your mom will get served, says Keith Cooperschmidt of Copyright Alliance. But he says, relax.
If your mother-in-law reads the notice, it'll be very clear that she can opt out. And all she has to do then is go to the Copyright Office website when this is all up and running, type in the number of the case, and just check the box that says opt out. I mean, it will be as easy as that.
So ideally, at the end of the day, your mom will just have to pay the $500 or whatever the photographer charges to post the wedding pics on Facebook. The CASE Act, says Cooperschmidt, also includes guardrails against copyright trolls, people who use frivolous lawsuits to make money.
There are harsh monetary penalties if somebody is found to be filing a frivolous claim, and that person, if they are found to do it more than once, i.e. they are a repeat violator or offender, they can be banned from using the court entirely.
The CASE Act limits how many claims people can file. And Cooperschmidt adds, no reasonable person would want to abuse the system.
But that's not terribly reassuring, you know, because there's going to be some unreasonable person who might.
Public knowledge lawyer Meredith Rose says our copyright law comes from a time when few of us had the means to reproduce copyrighted work. Obviously, that's changed.
Copyright law is just a mess. I mean, there are a lot of copyright lawyers who wouldn't have a job if it wasn't a mess.
A lot of people today want to earn their livings as creatives. The only point of agreement might be that the internet should make it easier, not harder. Neto Ulibi, NPR News.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Hearing loss is a fact of life for many humans, but not for fish, reptiles, or birds.
People noticed in chickens that they could take them to, say, a heavy metal concert, blast the ears really to oblivion, and then within days, new hair cells would begin to sprout.
The science of sound. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
We're deep into tax season, and the IRS requires you to file your federal return 1 month from today, April 15th. Many states also have a deadline of April 15th. We're going to check in now with personal finance expert Jill Schlesinger to answer some tax questions. Jill is a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Jill, it's worth noting that 2021 looks to be a return to normal for the most part. Federal taxes are going to be due on April 15th, as we said. No extension unless you file for one, so it's back to the old rules. But there are new circumstances because of the pandemic. Many people last year moved to another state because they could work virtually, and some people moved out of state to be with family. Does the government need to know for tax purposes that you weren't working in your usual state?
This concept of jurisdiction is one of the big questions I've been getting on my podcast and the radio show for the past 3-6 months. So I spoke to a bunch of folks at the American Institute of CPAs, and they do recommend that you do a little work on this. Compile the number of days you worked in various states or cities, any jurisdiction that you worked in remotely during 2020. Then you're going to check each state's rules about other jurisdictions to see if you need to make any adjustments. Right now, the deadline is April 15th. Don't wait. Get a jump on it.
So one other question about working from home. If you
bought some furniture, if you use more electricity because you're working from home and you're online more often than you would have been otherwise, is that deductible?
It depends. If you are an employee, meaning you're somebody that gets a W-2, you don't get to deduct any business expenses anymore. Now, if you're self-employed, you're a gig worker, then of course that home office deduction is still available. For everyone else, I'm sorry that you paid for a nice chair or a stand-up desk, but you're going to have to swallow that one.
And how about people who lost their jobs and are receiving unemployment benefits, including increased benefits? Do they face a higher tax burden because of that? Because you have to pay taxes on unemployment.
Well, the IRS has always said unemployment benefits are taxable. However, the government is now saying if you made less than $150,000 last year and you received unemployment, any unemployment benefits up to $10,200, you're not going to pay tax on it. That's a huge change, though. Unemployment benefits, a big change, but for only 2020.
The IRS is managing all these rules, the returns, and the distribution of stimulus checks from the relief bill at the same time. But does it mean for us that things might be slower in terms of possibly getting a refund or getting an answer if we have to call the IRS?
I would never call the IRS. I would go to the website. They have a fantastic website, irs.gov. It's searchable. There's a ton of information on there, so don't call. I do think that this is going to take you following up on any outstanding issues because it's going to be very hard to rely on the IRS to get back to you.
So how do you follow up if you have not received your stimulus payment yet? Some people have, some people haven't. If you haven't, what do you do?
Well, if you didn't get your first or your second stimulus payments, then what you are going to do is when you file your taxes for 2020, you're going to claim what's called the recovery rebate credit. Now, why is this so important? Because the conditions of your family size and your income could have changed. Things could be different, but you must file with your returns that recovery rebate credit to get anything you thought you were due in those first two stimulus payments.
I'm so glad you have the answers. Jill Schlesinger is CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
This morning, the Academy Award nominees were announced. Netflix's Mank led the field with 10 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture. Mank is the story of screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz, who won an Oscar for co-writing Orson Welles' iconic film Citizen Kane. Here's Gary Oldman as Mankiewicz.
I built him a watertight narrative and a suggested destination. Where he takes it, that's his job.
But diversity was the headline of the day in a number of categories. Joining me to talk about that and this year's nominees is KPCC Entertainment reporter John Horn. John, welcome back.
Happy to be with you.
And we're going to dig into the nominees in just a minute, but I want to start with the fact that this year the Academy did something new. It opened up the nominations to films that were only available via streaming services. Of course, that was a result of the pandemic. But how much of a difference did that make?
Well, this is like a fundamental rule of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and that is that a film has to premiere in a theater. This year, obviously, for the past year, most theaters have been closed, so the Academy made a change to its rule that you could premiere on a streaming service or on a premium video on demand site and still be eligible. And that fundamentally changed the kinds of movies that were going to be contending. A lot more streaming films, and also at the same time, because theaters were closed, the major studios basically sat out the year. I mean, it's not as if the next Fast and Furious movie was going to be an Oscar contender, but when the studios kind of vacate the space completely, it opens an opportunity not only for streaming movies, but for independently produced films, which tend to be much more diverse, and that's what I think we saw in this year's nominations.
Well, we absolutely did. Let's start talking about that. Two women nominated for Best Director. We've got Chloe Zhao for Nomadland and Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman. That is something that has never happened before.
No, not only has it never happened, but in the history of the Academy Awards, only one woman has ever won the directing Oscar. That was Kathryn Bigelow almost a decade ago for The Hurt Locker. Chloe Zhao is the first non-white woman ever to be nominated in the category. Also, Chloe not only directed Nomadland, she also wrote it, produced it, and edited it. So Chloe Zhao has four nominations this year, the most by any woman in a single year. And in fact, in total, 70 women received a combined 76 nominations, which is also a record in a single year.
Wow. Now, of course, the nomination is one thing, but if one of those two women don't win, you know people will be upset about that. What are their chances?
I think Chloe's got a great chance. I mean, I think Nomadland is the favorite to win Best Picture. I think she's absolutely the favorite to win Best Director. Nomadland, even though it's made by an imprint of the Walt Disney Company, Searchlight Studios, it is very much an independent film. Chloe is an independent filmmaker. This is a narrative adaptation of a great nonfiction book by Jessica Bruder. I think it's not only a great movie, but it's certainly a good movie for these times. It's about people kind of coming together in desperate circumstances. I love this film, and I think it's really the front runner for picture and for director.
Hmm. It does look good. Why don't we talk about Best Actor? Riz Ahmed nominated for The Sound of Metal, Anthony Hopkins for The Father, Gary Oldman for Mank, Steven Yeun for Minari, and of course, this is the big one, the late Chadwick Boseman for his role as a trumpeter in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Let's listen to a little of a scene.
I got talent. Oh, me no. And this horn, we's tight. If my daddy had a note I was going to turn out like this, he would have named me Gabriel.
Oh.
I'm going to get me a band and make me some records. I done give Mr. Stutterman some of my songs I wrote, and he said he going to let me record them when I get my band together. I just got to finish the last part of this song. I got style.
John, when Chadwick Boseman's widow accepted his Golden Globe Award, it was one of the most moving moments of the night. Do you think he is a clear frontrunner this year?
You know, it's a great field. And I got to say, Steven Yeun and Minari, he's the first Asian performer nominated in the lead actor category. Also a great performance. So who knows? Obviously, a lot of sentiment behind Chadwick Boseman. It's a great performance. But oddly enough, the film was not nominated for Best Picture, which a lot of people thought it would be. And I think when you don't have that kind of critical support in the Best Picture race, it might suggest a little weakness of support for the film overall. But Chadwick is absolutely deserving, as is Viola Davis, who he starred opposite in the film, who I think is probably, you know, the most favored actress category winner going forward.
Well, why don't we talk about the women then? Along with Miss Davis, there's Vanessa Kirby for Pieces of a Woman, Carrie Mulligan for Promising Young Woman, Frances McDormand for Nomadland, and Andra Day, who plays singing great Billie Holiday in The United States versus Billie Holiday. She sings as well as acts in that role, and here she is performing Holiday's signature song, Strange Fruit.
Silent trees, they're strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
She is a remarkable performer. I had a chance to watch her sing with the pianist and composer Chris Bowers a couple months ago for something unrelated to the Oscars, and she is so full of emotion, and her phrasing is unbelievable. You know, she is somebody who we're going to be hearing a lot about. Obviously a fantastic singer, but also a really good actor. That's a, you know, very tricky category. I think Viola Davis is probably the favorite, but the fact that a movie like Promising Young Woman, now this is a very difficult movie. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival more than a year ago. It's about a woman who basically exacts revenge on men who she pretends to be, you know, drunk and incapacitated at bars, and she basically turns the tables on men who try to take advantage of her. It's a very difficult film. The fact that this movie is getting the kind of support from the Academy that it's getting is remarkable, and I think that is a great example of what happens during a pandemic year, that a movie like Promising Young Woman can rise as high as it has risen.
Mm-hmm. And John, we've been talking about this, that the pandemic has caused so much disruption this year. The Oscars were pushed back to late April. As we said, they opened up the nomination process to streaming services. But you also say that there may be almost a bit of an upside in this year's nominations because of that. Can you explain what you mean?
Well, what it does is it kind of levels the playing field. When you eliminate the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent on four-year consideration ads and parties and events, a lot of money is spent on Oscar promotion. And when you can't have those events because of the pandemic and you're really limited on what you can spend because people aren't going to the movies, I think it does reflect, you know, more of a consensus of what people really like. The fact that the studios, you know, skip the year, I think, creates an opening for these smaller independent films. But also the Academy has really tried over the last, you know, 7 to 8 years to diversify its membership. They've invited a lot more younger and more diverse members. And even though once you're in for life, it's like The Godfather, like you don't get to leave unless something bad happens to you. The change of the demographics within the voting ranks is clearly noticeable, and it's the reason why I think a lot of these nominees got as much love. I mean, this is a record year for diversity in the acting ranks, and I think that's a reflection of how the Academy has diversified, also the kinds of movies they had to choose from, a very diverse slate that was not top-heavy with a lot of kind of old-fashioned studio films that tend to skew very white and very male.
So I guess the real question will be, like, next year, if the Academy Awards are still as open to including the streaming services, what do you think? I mean, is this sort of setting a precedent that could change the way these awards ceremonies are done from here on out?
Yeah, it feels like the classic bell you can't unring. And yes, let's hope next year will be different. But I can't see anything changing back because the world has changed. I mean, who knows? Even in California right now, you can start going back to movie theaters. I don't know anybody who is ready to go back to a movie theater. And I also don't think that financial model makes sense anymore. So if the Academy is going to reflect the best in movie making, I think it has to be agnostic about platforms because some of the best work is coming out on Netflix or Amazon, other streaming sites. And if you restrict the Oscars to movies that only play in theaters, because theaters won't play films that are debuting on streaming services, you know, within a couple weeks, if not the same day as they're hitting theaters, then you're cutting off like more than half of the best work in Hollywood. And if the Academy is recognizing the best in filmmaking, it cannot ignore what's happening in streaming services because that's some of the best work in Hollywood right now.
We've been talking about the Oscar nominees out this morning with KPCC Entertainment reporter John Horn. The ceremony will be April 25th. It's a late one this year because of the pandemic. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Salman Rushdie was born in Pakistan in 1944. He came to the United States in his early 20s for grad school. He eventually settled in New England and became a professor of biology at Rhode Island College. He worked there for more than three decades. Rushdie is one of more than 530,000 Americans who've died from COVID-19 in the past year, and we've been remembering some of them. Today, Rushdie's daughter, Noreen, shares his story.
My parents took all the precautions. They were masked, they were social distancing, and I never thought that they would get it in their small little town. I would definitely describe my father as a homebody. I used to say that even if somebody gave Dad a fully paid trip anywhere he wanted to go, he would rather stay home. He has to take care of the plants and check the mail. That's what he would say. My parents used to have a lot of musical evenings where they would sing old Bollywood songs together with their friends, with like a speaker system and a mic. The moment you walk into our home, there's a sunroom and there's a beautiful worn leather armchair with all his books that he's collected. I mean, hundreds and hundreds. The bookshelf goes up to the ceiling. When he would visit Pakistan, he would go to the antique shops and the old bazaars and pick up, you know, big copper platters and Persian rugs and, you know, different knickknacks. But that sunroom was like his abode, and he was just always there. He was always sitting there, and... So after my dad passed, I started, you know, going through the basement, and I just found boxes and boxes of documents from his life, letters, postcards. There was a journal from 1978 where he had spent a few months back home in Pakistan, and he talks about how this is my home, but I don't feel at home here anymore. You just never see that side of a parent, you know, and he clearly had intricate feelings and thoughts and experiences. So I wish I knew more about that. But he doesn't know about that part of me as well. So maybe that's life. My mom started feeling a few mild symptoms, and then a few days later, my dad started feeling the same symptoms. He tested positive right after Thanksgiving, and the whole week he said, I feel fine. The next week, I had messaged my mom, and she said, you know, Dad's feeling really weak and slightly disoriented, and I said, what is his oxygen level? And she said, 80. I said, you need to go to the hospital right now. She said, I dropped him outside of the ER. He refused a wheelchair. He walked in and he never walked out. On December 27th, they called, and I can still hear them telling my mom, your husband, he didn't make it. And I can see my mom's face, and that was it. You know, every night we would call, and the nurse would keep the phone next to his ear, and we would play him his favorite old Bollywood songs from the 1950s. Those were the ones that he would sing solo with a microphone in our sunroom. And there's one about, you know, the weather being so beautiful on a certain day. And we played that for him while he was in the hospital, and my mom was singing along with it. I mean, we don't know if he heard us, but we can hope he did.
Noreen Wasti remembering her father Salman. The story comes from member station WBUR and was produced by Chloe Axelson and Franny Kartoff. It's part of collaboration with Faces of COVID, a project that remembers the people behind the statistics. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.
काली काली घटा डर रही है।